start with our summary statement. Psalm 101 sings of Yahweh's covenant mercy. And justice through the king. Of David's house. So go over that again. Psalm 101 sings of Yahweh's covenant mercy and justice through the king of David's house. So this psalm divides evenly in half, and so the outline will be verses 1 to 4, righteous reign. Verses 5 to 8, righteous judgment. So go over that again. Verses 1 to 4, righteous reign. Verses 5 to 8, righteous judgment. All right, so let's go to our observations for Psalm 101. This psalm was written by David. You can see that on the superscription, a psalm of David. The word for psalm there indicates it is singing with musical or instrumental accompaniment. And there are two words for singing that also occur in the text in verse 1 of the psalm. And the word for singing in the first verse is the word for singing voice, singing. The word for singing in the second verse speaks of instruments, musical accompaniment. And aside from that, there's no other musical direction in the psalm. There's no occasion that is given for the writing of the psalm. And really, there's not anything here that would indicate any particular occasion in David's life. If I were going to try to put an occasion to it, it might be after God had made his covenant known with David. But that would really just sort of be not very much to go on there. Could be possible. The psalm does envision a future scene, much like the psalms before it, though, a scene, because this was a scene that has never yet been fulfilled. So we're familiar with that, and we'll talk about that a little more later. Psalm 101 is primarily a wisdom psalm. And so we've seen just a series of praise psalms in book number 4, and now we are sort of changing gears a little bit, and we're seeing this is primarily a wisdom psalm. So you have certain wisdom elements in it. So the word in verse number 2 that is translated, behave myself wisely, and that's translating one word there. That word there is actually one of the common words in Proverbs that's used for wisdom or understanding. We also have the use of way, which is the Hebrew derech, which occurs in the Proverbs. The most dominant metaphor in the Proverbs for way. It's a word literally means a road or a path, but it's used more figuratively to speak of a way of life. And so it gives us this imagery, that the wise are on one particular path and the fools are on another path. So that's that word. It's used there in verse 2 and in verse 6. We also in this psalm get a clear contrast between the righteous and the wicked, as in two different ways. We also get a commitment to reject the way of the wicked and to cling to the blameless way of the righteous. So these are very strong wisdom elements. We do have some minor elements in the psalm. So it is a petition psalm in the sense that verse 2 does petition, when wilt thou come unto me? It is also a kingship psalm. Not entirely in what we've seen in the several psalms previous to this. But when you look at the text of the psalm, it speaks of having servants of the house, speaks of destroying the wicked from the earth and cutting off the wicked from the city of the Lord. And these are elements of reigning in the Lord's kingdom. This psalm is also what we would call prophetic predictive. And when you look at the psalm, you realize that it is very future oriented. We've seen a number of psalms that have looked back on historical events and then looked forward. And well, this psalm purely looks forward. And again, it envisions the righteous reign in the house of David in Jerusalem. And that righteous reign is contingent upon the visitation of Yahweh. And so that is anticipated in the psalm. Psalm 101 begins a new small subgroup of psalms, and we've noticed these the psalms being divided into books, and then from there being divided into smaller groups. And so we have a subgroup that starts here with Psalm 101, but it does have very clear connections with the psalms previous to it. For one, you have the use of the term Hesed, God's covenant mercy, and we see that in Psalm 90 in verse 14, Psalm 92 in verse 2, Psalm 94 in verse 18, Psalm 98 in verse 3, and Psalm 100 in verse 5. Not only that, but also the use of judgment, Psalm 94 in verse 15, Psalm 97 in verse 2, Psalm 97 in verse 8, Psalm 99 in verse 4. We also get the concept of the ideal king, and that comes out here in verses 2 to 8. It comes out in Psalm 93 in verse 1, in Psalm 94, Psalm 96 in verse 10, Psalm 97 verses 1 and 2, Psalm 98 in verse 6, and Psalm 99 in verse 1. We get the question of how long. Now here it is, and it's the same word actually that's used, when or how long. In this question, and when wilt thou come unto me in verse 2. But we also saw that question in Psalm 90 verses 13 and 14, Psalm 94 verses 3 and 4. We've got this reference to singing and in verse number 1 here and in verses Psalm 96 verse 1 and 2, Psalm 98 in verse 1. Reference to, and that would be singing vocally. And then we have this reference to singing that's more in terms of musical instrumentation. That's the second word that's used in verse 1. And we see that that same word is used in Psalm 92 in verse 1, Psalm 98 in verses 4 and 5. Also, the judgment of the wicked here in verse 8 and in places like Psalm 92 in verse number 7. So there are a numerous connections with the psalms that have come prior to this. And then also, those psalms that start book number 4, we've noted from the beginning how that they shared a lot of connections with Psalm 89. And so that is the same case here with Psalm 101. It shares those connections with Psalm 89 as well. So Psalm 89 was the end of book number 3. Psalm 89, of course, is very concerned with God's chesed. Psalm 89, verses 1 and 2, verse 14, verse 24, verse 28, verse 33, and verse 49. And also this same term for judgment appears in Psalm 89 in verses 14 and 30. And also singing, in fact, specifically singing of the Lord's chesed, which happens in Psalm 89 in verse 1. And it's the same way that it starts out in Psalm 101. All right, so the poetic features of Psalm 101, the psalm is structured as a pledge or like an oath of office. And so in this psalm, you see these repeated commitments. And so you see, I will, that occurs 7 times in the psalm, and we get at one that is essentially an I will not. So it is structured sort of like an oath of office. It's a commitment to reign in a particular way. We get repetition in this psalm, so repetition of perfect in verses 2 and 6, house in verse 2 and 7. eye or eyes or sight or presence that's indicated by the same term, verses 3, 5, 6, and 7. And also this reference to the cutting off, verses 5 and 8 in particular. We get a minor parallelism in verse number 7, and this is where you have the statement of something that is the same thing, but it's a little bit different. And so in verse 7, you get reference to deceit and then telling lies in the second part. And so that's a parallel. But beyond that, those are the most major poetic type features. Not a lot of imagery and that sort of thing. So we want to work our way through this psalm, 8 verses. So I'm going to go ahead and read these. I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. O, when wilt thou come unto me? I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. I hate the work of them that turn aside. It shall not cleave to me. A froward heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. Whoso privily slandereth his neighbor, him will I cut off. Him that hath an high look and a proud heart will not I suffer. Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land, and they that dwell with me, that they may dwell with me. He that walketh in a perfect way, he shall serve me. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within mine house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. I will early destroy all the wicked of the land, that I may cut off all the wicked doers from the city of the Lord. So verse 1 is the opening commitment. I will sing of the mercy and judgment unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. So this is the opening commitment of singing to the Lord. The word for mercy, of course, is the Hebrew term chesed that we have noted a number of times. That is a word that refers typically to covenant mercy, and especially in a context like this, it does have covenantal reference. The word for judgment is a word that means decision or a verdict, like we might refer to a judge issuing a judgment in a case. And so it's obviously speaking of justice, the executing of justice, the maintaining of justice in the reign over the people. So this is obviously a covenantal reference. I will sing of the Lord's mercy and justice. Now, the first word for sing, again, it refers to singing with the voice. And the second word actually literally means something like to strike or to touch. It's a word that meant to touch the strings and indicates playing of a stringed instrument. So in modern terms, you know, that'd be like a guitar, banjo, or violin, or piano, because it is a stringed instrument. So playing the strings. Verses 2-4 then begins these vows, these commitments. The last part of verse number 2 in particular, or rather in the middle, you have that question. And so verses 2-4 begin these vows of living and walking in a blameless way, or a way of innocence, a way of uprightness or righteousness. So the word for behave myself wisely, that's a word for wisdom or understanding. Particularly the way that it's used here is in the sense of getting wisdom or of observing wisely. And then we get this echo, O when wilt thou come unto me? This echoes this how long question. Now, we saw this how long question a number of times come up in laments. And we've seen it a little bit in book number 4 of the Psalms as well. And the question, this how long question, is a question that reveals an expectation. In other words, there's a promise underlying it. It's not a petition that goes to the Lord and just says, Lord, will you do this? You know, I would like for you to do this, or I you know, will you do this? But it's a petition saying, how long until you do this? In other words, God has indicated in some way that he's going to do this. And so that's what this prayer of how long, that's what this prayer indicates. There's an expectation that of a promise being fulfilled that is underneath this petition. Now here, the promise that's underneath this petition is the Davidic covenant. And that has been the primary covenant under consideration in book number 4 in particular, and at the end of book number 3. We've talked a number of times how, as you go into the Psalms, that the Davidic covenant is the primary covenant under consideration. The Abrahamic covenant is also under consideration at different places in different ways. But the Davidic covenant is primarily the covenant that's underlying the whole of the book of the Psalms. Psalm 89 that ends book number 3, of course, is a long lament that it seems that this Davidic covenant has failed. The house of David lies in the dust, the throne, the crown, all of these things in the dust. The Davidic lineage has failed. The throne has failed. The kingdom has failed. And so this covenant has failed. And well, this is the covenant that is being referred to in this particular psalm. So the promise of the Davidic covenant, in particular, that God would raise up his king from the line of David. And again, that covenant is found in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 8 to 16. And so that is what is underlying this petition of David. The petition for visitation. When wilt thou come unto me? So he's praying for the visitation of Yahweh. Now, when you study particularly the Psalms, but also in the prophets, the visitation of Yahweh means one thing for the covenant faithful, and it means something else for the wicked. So the visitation of Yahweh for the wicked means their destruction. It means judgment upon them, their undoing. But the visitation of Yahweh to those who have taken refuge in him, those who have faith in him, have put their trust in him, who are in covenant relationship with him, his visitation means blessing, and particularly blessing in the form of the performance of the promises that he has made, that he has covenanted himself to. So that is what this petition is in this psalm, and that's actually what everything that flows from this psalm, that's what it relies upon, the visitation of Yahweh, which means the fulfillment or the performance of his promises. And so from here then we get further commitment. He is committing, I will walk blamelessly. I will set nothing of Belial before me. And that's the word for wicked there when it says, I'll set no wicked thing before my eyes. The word for wicked there is the word Belial. And essentially he's saying that he will not look after or, you might say lust after, any demonic works. And that word for Belial does have that idea of demonic power or work or something to it. In other words, it's not just something morally bad or morally objectionable, but actually something satanic. And I'll set no such thing. He will not look after or lust after any such satanic or demonic thing. He rejects those that turn away from righteousness. And he will not abide a perverse or a crooked mind. Now, the idea of perverse or crooked that's used here and comes up a number of times in Proverbs as well is the idea of something being bent away from the way of righteousness. And you might think of it maybe in the way that sometimes plants and flowers, how they will turn and open up toward the sunshine. And so this would be like a plant or flower that bends away, that tries to escape the sunshine. It turns away from it. So that's this crooked or perverse mind. It's turned away from the way of righteousness and turned away from the way of wisdom. And that will not be abided, nor will he know a wicked person. Now, again, the word for know here has the idea of an intimate fellowship, and certainly it's something that's used often more euphemistically with the relationship of a husband and a wife, but it's also used in the context of a friendship, a close fellowship, a close association. And so what he is saying is that he will not enter into partnership or close association or friendship with a wicked person. And then as we look at verses 5 to 8 that are the second half of this psalm, we see that we move from these personal commitments now to what we might call public commitments, because this is a commitment to righteous judgment. How is he going to execute the office in which he has been installed? So as you look through these commitments in verses 5 to 8, you notice that there's a proper distinction that is maintained between the righteous and the wicked. In other words, there's going to be a proper discernment between the righteous and the wicked. Private slander and pride are things that will not be tolerated. There will be a reward for the faithful. They will have safe dwelling in the land with him, with the king, with the ruler. There will be no deceit or false counselors that will be tolerated in the house. In other words, in the government of the king, there's not going to be allowed any deceit, any taking of bribes and perverting of justice and all of those sort of things that will not be permitted. Now the word for early there in verse number 8, I will early destroy all the wicked. The word actually literally means daybreak. It's a word that refers to dawn, essentially means morning. And the way that it's being used is indicating that this is going to be a quick and a consistent action. So think of it as like a commitment, that every morning when you get up, you're going to do X, whatever that is. You're going to we might refer to that as a discipline or a practice or whatever you want to call it. But it's a quick and consistent action. So in other words, regularly he will cut off those that do evil from the city of the Lord, so that the city will be maintained in holiness and righteousness. Now, the words for destroy and cut off that are used here, they are similar words, and they're both used in different ways to speak of what we might think of as disinheritance. It's going to be cut off from the kingdom. Maybe you have been or maybe you have even threatened, to cut someone out of your will, sort of thing. That's sort of the idea. They're going to be cut off from inheritance. And of course, that means cut off from the kingdom, cut off from everlasting life, cut off from the presence of God, all those sort of things. So it's used this way in Psalm 18 and verse 40, Psalm 54 and verse 5, Psalm 73 and verse 27, and more recently in Psalm 94 and verse 23. And then the other word is used in Psalm 34, verse 16, and in Psalm 37, verses 9, 28, 34, and 38, again, to speak of disinheritance. And then we get this final reference to the city of the Lord, and the city of the Lord refers to Zion or Jerusalem. We can see the city of the Lord referred to in Psalm 46 and verse 4, Psalm 48 and verse 18, and Psalm 87 and verse number 3. All right, so let's go to interpretation. So Psalm 101 teaches the code of the king, you could call it. And it covers aspects of personal righteousness and public righteousness. So if you're thinking about like the evaluation or the expectation of a righteous king, well, that's going to cover a personal righteousness, and it's also going to cover a public righteousness, the way that they execute the office. And so the aspects of personal righteousness include things like walking blamelessly according to wisdom. And you could also sum up that first part as well as hating and rejecting those things that God hates. So we think of like Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. And we can also see those things named in this psalm as well. And then you have the aspect of public righteousness. So public righteousness would be the execution of how that the king governs, how that the king rules, how that he judges the people. So the proper execution of justice among the people. And that would involve punishing wrongdoing and rewarding righteousness. So the punishment of wrong and the rewarding of right. And of course, those would be according to God's standard of what is right and what is wrong. So that would be a perfectly just rule and reign by the king. So what this code then describes for us is the ideal king. And it represents the commitment that David made as the king of God's choice. Or sometimes the phrase is a king after God's own heart. He was God's choice for king. And so David's response as the king of God's choice was to commit himself to personal and public righteousness as king over Israel. All right, so that brings us then to the messianic hope. And the messianic hope of this psalm is seen through David's failure to keep this code. He committed himself to it, but we know that he failed to keep it. And in fact, when you look at the last words of David before his death, he acknowledged that he had not kept the code and that his house was not ideal. But he took comfort in God's covenant promises. So these are the last words of David. 2 Samuel chapter 23, verses 1 to 7. Now these be the last words of David, David the son of Jesse, and the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, "The Spirit of the Lord spake by me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springeth out of the earth by clear shining after rain." So this is what God requires of a righteous king. And this is what David committed to. This is what he committed his way to, but he failed to keep. David failed to keep personal righteousness. We can obviously think of the situation with Bathsheba. We can think of his public righteousness and how it failed in terms of his dealing with Uriah, in later terms with Absalom, and some of those different things that happened in David's life. So this is what David said, and I'm just continuing here from 2 Samuel 23. This is verse 5 now. This is what David said. So after he speaks of this ideal king, he says, "Although my house be not so with God, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things, and sure, for this is all my salvation and all my desire, although he make it not to grow. But the sons of Belial shall be all of them as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. But the man that shall touch them must be fenced with iron and the staff of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in the same place." So David recognized that he failed to live up to this code of the ideal king. He failed to live up to that. He failed to have a house and a lineage that lived up to that. So his hope, though, was not in himself, and it wasn't even in his own house. His hope was in God and the covenant that he made with David, that the ideal king of his house would rule. And so this psalm looks forward to that time, and this failure of David, and the fact that it was one that would come after David that would this covenant would be fulfilled with, is also recognized by the prophet. So I want to read just a few places where the prophets speak of this as well. So Isaiah chapter 16, in verse 1 he talks about going to Zion. Let's go to verse 5. "And in mercy," and that is hesed that is used there, "shall the throne be established," talking about in Zion from verse number 1, "and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness." Now this is spoken of the Messiah, the servant of Yahweh who was to come, the Holy One of Israel in Isaiah's prophecy. So think about things that Isaiah said about this one. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 7. "Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." And then in chapter 11, in verses 1 and 2. "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord." Well, we go a little bit forward to Jeremiah. Remember that Jeremiah prophesies. Jeremiah lives in the day when he sees the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, and the carrying away of Judah into Babylon. Jeremiah writes, Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David." Now, this is long since David has died and been his body been laid to rest. "I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely, and this is his name whereby he shall be called the Lord our righteousness." Also think of the prophecy in Amos chapter 9 and verse 11. "In that day will I raise up the tabernacle or the house of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old." So Psalm 89 laments that the house of David has fallen, that it has fallen into ruin, and it's fallen into catastrophe, and the line of David has fallen, and there is no king. And of course, as we come into book 4, we have seen answers time and again, answers to that particular lament and that particular concern. And here we have a Psalm of David where David is envisioning this righteous reign. He's envisioning this righteous reign by the righteous son of David. David knows that he doesn't live up to this. Even in his covenant, God had told him, "You're going to die, you're going to be laid to rest with your fathers, and it's going to be after that that I'm going to raise up this one to sit on your throne." But we also get promises where the house and the throne of David is going to be restored, is going to be raised up, and the glory of that house is going to be seen when the Messiah comes. So now we can think about reading this psalm in the flow of the Psalms, and this has been a part of this particular study, how that these psalms work with the other psalms, particularly those that are in close proximity to it, as well as others. So if you're reading this psalm in the flow of the psalms here, you come out of Psalm 89, you come out of the end of book number 3, you go into book number 4, and particularly when we think about Psalm number 100, Psalm 100 envisions the nations streaming to Jerusalem in the Messiah's kingdom. And this psalm now is envisioning his execution of perfect justice in that kingdom. So what we're looking at here is a description of what is prophesied in places going all the way back to Psalm number 2 and verses 6 to 9. "Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said unto me, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen, the nations, the goyim, for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel." He's going to rule the nations, we're told, with a rod of iron. And that is being described. So when you look at verse number 8 in particular, he says, "I will early destroy the wicked of the land." That is the word that is very often translated earth. It's the same word that means those habitable parts of the earth. So in other words, he says, in this reign, I'm going to destroy the wicked out of the earth. Those wicked nations out of the earth, they will be rooted out. "And I will cut off all wicked doers from the city of the Lord." As all those nations are streaming to Jerusalem before the Lord, he's going to judge them with perfect judgment. And when we read, like in those last chapters of Isaiah, how that he's going to punish those that do evil in his kingdom, when he sits on the throne ruling with a rod of iron, it is going to be to punish those that do evil in that kingdom. And of course, this is the time before the eternal age. All right, let's go to application. Stuck with one primary application here for Psalm 101. So understanding Psalm 101 helps us understand the practical application of David's commitment. All right, so when we've been looking at applications of the psalm, we've wanted to ask the question, you know, what does this psalm speak to us in any way? Does it say anything to us as modern readers? And what do we take away from that? So when we think about David's commitment here, David understood the Lord's promises of a righteous king. And he wrote psalms like Psalm 16 that speaks of how that Messiah will rise from the dead, from the grave. He wrote psalms like Psalm 22 where he described how that anointed one would be crucified. When you look at the details of Psalm 22, this was written a long, long time before crucifixion had really been invented as a method of execution. And yet he's describing crucifixion in great detail in Psalm 22. And then we look at a place like this where he's envisioning the righteous reign of the Son of David. So David understood the Lord's promises of a righteous king, and this was his response. He committed himself to the way of righteousness. So, when we read this psalm, and understand, we don't reign. Like, for instance, it's not our responsibility to destroy all of the wicked of the earth. We don't have that right. We don't have that authority. We don't have that power. We can't cut off all wicked doers from the city of Jerusalem. That's not our right. That's not our power. So we look at this psalm, we understand David's response to the promises of the Lord, and we see that it is our place to walk the way of the blameless king after him. Do you believe in a Messiah? Do you believe in Jesus Christ? Well, if we do, then that means that we also are committing our lives to walk in the way of righteousness after him. We are to walk in the way that he walks. Yes, like David, we will not do this with complete perfection, but we like David, are also committing ourselves to the pursuit of righteousness in heart and in life. And again, that's the primary application that we're sticking with in this particular psalm. Any questions or anything on Psalm 101? So he celebrates the mercy and the justice of God in the sense that perfect justice will reign during that kingdom. So that reign. In other words, if you think, for instance, like the early part of Psalms and most of the David Psalms, the enemies are the wicked. They're the nations. They're the wicked in the nations that are around Israel, but they're also the wicked within the nation of Israel, as David was subject to rebellions and you know, how long did Saul and the armies of Israel, you know, seek David's life? So David, he is celebrating that, yes, there's going to be a time of perfect justice and perfect mercy. So those that those that trust in the Lord, well, they're going to receive mercy. And David knows that he's received mercy from the Lord. He's you know, nearing death, and he's acknowledging, I have not kept all of this. I have not been as I should be. I have failed in many ways, but that is not like the Lord. You know, the Lord has made a covenant, and that covenant is ordered and sure. It will be fulfilled perfectly. So I do believe that he is celebrating, envisioning that perfect righteousness and justice and mercy, where the wicked will be judged according to their works, and the righteous who have trusted in the Lord will receive mercy. Does that answer the question you're asking?
I just think
it is. I think that we celebrate justice in the sense that we can comprehend that it will be righteous and holy. There will be nothing unfair, unholy, you know, unrighteous about God's justice. And those that do not believe, I mean, they're going to be, you know, judged for their sins one day. And for us that believe, we can think about what mercy, that we're never going to receive what we truly deserve because Jesus received that in our place. Sure. And it's hard for us to, part of the reason why, if I understand what you're saying, I think part of the reason why that we struggle in sort of the celebration, you might say, of judgment is because, you know, we're so limited. We don't fully know, we don't fully understand, and we're not capable of rendering proper judgment. You know, we're not capable of doing that. But, you know, it's a place where we trust in the Lord, and, you know, we have to leave that in His hands and trust that, you know, He's holy and righteous in all that He does.